Hello, everybody. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial over at www.audibletrial.com/cinemarecall. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. So sign up today and get your free audio download book. Again, that site is audibletrial.com/cinemarecall. Now, enjoy the show.
This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this another episode of the Cinema Recall Podcast over at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, The Vern, and I am very, very happy to have on the show with us Mr. Tony Coogan of Coogan's Movie Reviews. Hello, good sir.
Hello.
Now, this is the first time you have appeared on Cinema Recall, and I don't think I could find a better movie to talk about than Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, earlier on the site, we posted a poll about the best Guillermo del Toro movies to talk about. And, of course, Pan's Labyrinth won. And I thank you a lot, Tony, for being on the show. But this is your time to shine, Tony. Tell the listeners out there about your site, which is, of course, Coogan's Movie Reviews.
So, yeah, so mostly on my site, Coogan's Reviews, it's mostly dedicated to going over... pretty much every film I see in the cinema. Sometimes it can take a while between when I actually see in cinema and getting to the review, but every single film I see in the cinema, I do a review of on my site. And occasionally I do like reviews of classic films that are in my blind spots, but haven't done that for a while, hoping to get back into that soon. But yeah, right now it's mostly dedicated to new cinema releases.
Well, very cool, man. Very cool. And you appeared on other podcasts I hosted there too. And I thank you that you want to come and talk to me on Cinema Recall. I thought for sure the last shows you'd be like, "No, Vern, I'm done. I'm done with you, man."
I'll never pass up a chance to talk about Del Toro.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, buddy. Thank you so much, man. Before we get into our episode of Pan's Labyrinth and Guillermo del Toro, we're going to take a small break. We're going to hear some ads from some other great podcast shows, and then we'll be back, all right? Stay tuned.
We'll return after these messages.
Check out the Blueprint Review podcast at blueprintreview.co.uk.
This could be interesting, yeah, because I know we've got some very diverse... I'm going to be arguing with Darren a lot.
Like, I think it's going to be me v you lot, with maybe Lauren set in the middle.
To be honest, I think it's about expectation. Yeah. Like, I think...
Yeah, I expected it to
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Do you like movie podcasts hosted by inebriated people? That's Kai with the cracking voice and Heather's touched by evil. One thinks he's Spider-Man, the other is a ninja. It's the Man I Love Films podcast, it's the MILFcast.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai.
And I'm Heather.
And we are the hosts of MILFcast, the Man I Love Films podcast, the unofficial, official podcast of manilovefilms.com. This is the podcast where we like to talk about what we've been watching, talk about movies, but mainly we just like to drink, be silly, and play a whole bunch of games. So we think every other week you should grab a drink, snuggle up, and let us make sweet love to your ears.
Otherwise, we'll make sweet love to your couch.
So come and find us on iTunes. Just search for MILFcast.
In a dark time, when hope was bleak, there lived a young girl whose only escape was in a legend that wanted her back. The legend speaks of the lost soul of a princess from another world who will one day be reborn. there will be signs that mark her return. There will be secrets that reveal her destiny. There will be a journey that will make you believe. Guillermo del Toro. In darkness, there can be light. In misery, there can be beauty. In death, there can be life. Labyrinth.
And we are back, everyone, to the Cinema Recall Podcast. You just heard some great ads along with a trailer for the Pan's Labyrinth. Not the Pan's Labyrinth, it's just Pan's Labyrinth. My apologies. Tony, where were you when you first saw this movie?
I probably saw it about a few years after it came out. It was probably around the time that of when Hellboy 2 was released, watched Hellboy 2, and that really got me interested in watching more of Guillermo del Toro's films. And it was also around that time I was starting to learn. I was doing GCSE in Spanish, which is my end of high school exams for people in America. So and doing a GCSE in Spanish, so I thought, you know, we may as well combine them both together and found a copy of Pan's Labyrinth and decided to watch it, and it's just a brilliant film. Like, it's so, like, remember the mix of, like, beauty and absolute horror that's in Pan's Labyrinth. And yeah. I don't think I've seen any other film that captures that mix, like that, and I don't think any other director would be able to do it, even be able to do it as well as Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I have seen, like, movies like Mimic before, and I remember seeing Hellboy, but I don't think I really took notice of del Toro's style until Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've even seen, like, Blade 2, and after I watched Pan's Labyrinth, and I saw the director, I'm like, oh, who's this director? Then I went back and looked at his filmography, and I forgot, oh, that's right, he did these movies. And it makes total sense, because Pan's Labyrinth is a creature feature, just like Hellboy and the creature from Mimic, which I still need to watch the director's cut of Mimic, because I remember watching that movie back on VHS a while back, and I thought it was just like a long string of like 90s creature movies with like phantoms and oh gosh, there's another, oh, the Relic, I think it was, all these like somewhat cheesy features, and so I'm definitely need to watch that film again. But yeah, Pan's Labyrinth kind of shocked me about how dramatic it was too. The lead actress in there is really good, and I'm kind of surprised she hasn't been in anything since then.
Yeah, I think she's been in, she was in the Shannara TV series, but haven't watched that, so I can't really say how acting's been like since Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, and I recognize, well, I remember, you know, Doug Jones being all the creatures in there, the main girl in this one, Ophelia, is Ivana Barreco, And, okay, for those of you out there that don't know what Pan's Labyrinth is about, it's about this little girl named Ophelia, played by Ivana Barco, and she goes to live with her mother's new boyfriend. The mother is played by Adriana Gill, and their stepfather is Vidal, played by Sergi Lopez. And the father is this really fascist, I guess, army general, would you say there, Tony?
Captain during the Spanish Civil War, yeah.
Yeah, captain, exactly, thank you for that. And while there, she meets up with this Fawn, played by Doug Jones, this weird guy who's got this tree for legs, and he's like half tree, half goat, who tells her that she's a princess, and that she must complete these three tasks in order to be accepted into this alternate world of being a princess. And it's a movie that basically juxtaposes the Spanish Civil War going on and also her fantasy task with these creatures. And it's a very beautiful movie. It's a movie that I watch every once in a while when I can, and I'm hoping to show my niece this movie because she's getting older now to check it out. But yeah, let's I guess get into kind of our favorite moments of the movie, unless you want to add anything to that plot description there, Tony.
It's more something just on to add stuff, little behind the scenes things. That basically just need to give massive props to Doug Jones because he does not speak Spanish, and he had to learn all of his lines phonetically so we could at least have the mouth movements right for another actor to dub in later. But and so yeah, just massive props to when he, especially when he was playing the Fawn, just massive props to him for being able to do the performance, both how heavy like the makeup must have been, and also he's doing it in a language he doesn't speak.
Yeah, I've read somewhere too that the legs that they used for the Fawn, they had to make him walk like backwards. They had to put his knees in like these really uncomfortable ways.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like walking backwards. He had like walk backwards with his knees bent in other ways too. And to try and have him move in those prosthetics for his legs. Yeah. And I do remember reading something about that too, and I was just really amazed about that. I think this may be the first, like, Spanish, or definitely the first foreign film I took my friends to see.
Yeah.
Because most of my friends, they will not watch any foreign film whatsoever. They would be like, no to that. But they really wanted to see this. And I was able to get them to stay with it. I think some of my friends were upset that there was not enough fantasy for them.
Yeah.
They thought the whole movie was going to be like this fantasy story. And when it got into the real life war elements involving the captain, and I think it was his housemate, Mercedes, she plays the, played by Maribel Verdú, who I remember from the film Why Tambiana? Why Move? I'm going to fuck up my Spanish here, but.
Y tu mama también?
Utiba, thank you. Thank you for that, yes. I remember her from that movie. And going back to what I was saying before about my friends there, they thought it was going to be like all fantasy. But I think some of the real-life elements, especially with the Rebels, are probably some of my like favorite moments.
Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
They kind of remind me of like almost like Woodland, like the Seven Dwarfs almost.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not best, like the Robin Hood's Merry Men as well.
Yes, yes, very good. Yes, Robin Hood's Merry Men. Yes, definitely. Well, without further ado, Tony, let's talk about our favorite moments of this movie here. Let's start with you, buddy. What was your favorite moment of Pan's Labyrinth?
Like we just mentioned, how some of the real world elements are. That are potentially better sides of the film than the fantasy worlds, and I'm gonna get right into that. And it's focused on the scene with Captain Vidal, and it's about two thirds way through the film when he's captured one of the rebels, and the rebel has a stammer, and you know, it's after Captain Bell's already done some torturing that rebel. He makes an offer to the rebel saying, if you can count to three without stammering, I'll let you go. And the moments that follow, it's some of the best. It's just so intense. It's like the most intense version of someone counting to three, and you're just hoping and so that he won't stammer. And it's just a brilliant performance from the rebel, just the fear and just the effort that he's trying to take just to suppress his stammer for just long enough that he could escape being tortured by Vidal. And also, just a brilliant, terrifying performance from Sergio Lopez, who, when Pan's album was being made, Del Toro was advised against casting Sergio Lopez as Vidal because he was more of a comedic actor or more of a melodramatic actor. But yeah, Del Toro won out casting Lopez, and it definitely pays off. He is terrifying in this. Part of Del Toro, a lot of the things Del Toro does in his films is actually raising the question of what exactly is a monster. It's like in a lot of Del Toro's films, the monsters are often like the kindest, most relatable characters in his films, and the real people are often the real monsters, the most terrifying people in his films. And Vidal in Pan's Labyrinth, that's the best example of the idea. It's like even the pale man, I don't think comes as close to being as terrifying as Vidal, because Vidal is a believable kind of monstrous. It's part of it is, for lack of a better term, is toxic masculinity with Vidal, and the whole idea of Vidal that he doesn't really even care about his new wife. He only cares about having a son. But
yeah, exactly. Now I want to ask you this, Tony, because there is a scene where Vidal is basically talking about how he met his wife, and that his wife was, I guess, working at like a clothes shop. But they do talk about the fact that Ophelia does have a father. And I want to know your opinion about this, Tony. Do you believe that Vidal has something to do with her father's death?
Definitely. I would not be surprised, even if it was like he arranged some circumstances for the death of you a few years ago, so he could do whatever stuff with Ophelia's mom. Yeah, it would not surprise me at all because of what we see of Vidal in the film. I do believe he would do that.
Yeah, because I think she was, Ophelia's mother was like making clothes for him or worked at some sort of like dry cleaner. I know she had something to do with the general, and apparently I think Ophelia's real father was, I don't know exactly what his job was.
Yeah, I can't quite remember that either.
Yeah, the captain was coming to Ophelia's mother at the store. She must have worked in a store, did something with his clothes, and then he was in love with her, and he decided, well, I gotta get rid of this other guy. And I'm sure that's what happened. He had him killed off, and he was starting to be like real nice to her. But yeah, just clear from the start that all he wants is just a son, someone to take over his reins. You mentioned about the torture scene there, with the scene where he talks about counting to three, and he's got all those tools there too.
Yeah.
And these are like really intricate small tools that he has too.
And from what we see, he goes for like the nails or other stuff that's even just the smallest bit of pressure or chance from those tools will cause excruciating pain. And no, Vidal, he knows exactly how to do it in such a way so that his captive will not die. And that idea is just terrifying, that how Vidal's knowledge of all of that stuff.
And he says too, he's kind of introducing each tool, like holding it up. Like, I'm going to start with this. Yeah. And then But when I get to this, I will believe everything you tell me. And we'll form a bond that's like brothers. And it's like, oh, I mean, this isn't a guy that just wants information. This is a guy that enjoys his craft very well, all right?
Yeah.
But I kind of want to hearken, I kind of want to harken back to an earlier scene when I guess some of his generals catch some supposed robbers.
Yeah.
And
that was it. Yeah.
That was like the first. Well, all right, let me explain. Let me set the scene here for listeners. So Videl is there with his army generals and two farmers who say that they were just hunting, and that's all his father's doing was just hunting for rabbits. I guess supposedly, according to Videl and his troops, they think that they're like rebel spies, and they're just out there to try to steal from them. And Videl takes this bottle, and he just bashes one of the young kids in the face so much that his nose breaks and his skull comes out. I mean, when that happened, that had to be the first, like, shocking moment. Because when I saw trailers for this and I saw that it was rated R, I thought, well, it doesn't seem to be that bad. I thought maybe it'd be language. Maybe a few intense scenes. But I was thinking more on the level of, like, action movie intense. All right? Like,
yeah.
R-rated tense right there. But when he takes that bottle and smashes that kid and seeing just small little chunks of his face come off, it reminded me of the fire in Secret... I don't know if you saw the movie Irreversible.
Yeah, I know which thing you're on about. Yeah, the fire extinguisher.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of that. And to have a scene like that, it kind of... this movie definitely played in more theaters than Irreversible for obvious reasons. But just to have a scene like that in kind of a somewhat fantasy movie was a little bit shocking. It made me go, all right, well, this is definitely an adult fairy tale. Because everything before the scene was kind of like magical and I guess whimsical.
Like magical realism, yeah.
Yeah, magical realism. But then that scene came to be really realistic.
Yeah, I think for me the bit that's freaked me out the most about that scene wasn't the actual beating with the like flat end, although that is part of it. It's just how there's absolutely no reaction from Videl. He almost looks bored during it.
Yes.
And even afterwards when he goes back searching the bags and actually finds the rabbits and Sans was, oh, you idiot, should have searched them better. He's just sounds so bored during it, like it's routine for him to do that torture. And I think that is part of what makes Videl such a terrifying figure.
Gosh. Yeah, the fact that it's just kinda standard, getting to one of my scenes, one of my big favorite scenes of this is the moment when Ophelia meets the Pale Man.
Yeah.
And, all right, so in the context of the plot, she has to do these tasks, and one of the tasks is to go into this lair with this creature to retrieve, I want to say, these keys or...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, but she's warned not to touch anything on this creature's table. And when she goes into the lair with the help of a white chalk to open a door, she goes in there and there's like all this wonderful food is stretched out. And you see this creature sitting at the end of the table and totally white face. And he's got these really long hands with long fingers. And like no eyes, but you see like two eyes on a bowl right next to him. And so she goes in there. She comes in there with her fairies, and they're trying to tell her to go to one moment of the room to get the keys. After she gets them, she sees the food there. She's so hungry. The fairies try to warn her, tell her not to take it, but she doesn't listen, and she takes the cherries or the grapes or something like that. And that's like when the creature awakes. Now, here's when I ask you about this, all right? Before the creature awakes and she's there, now she heard the warning not to touch anything. Do you think that she just didn't believe it, or was she somewhat, I guess, hypnotized?
I think it was more due to hunger, because I mean, it's setting the scene for this. Before this scene, after Ophelia's first task, where she had to get something from the belly of a giant toad, and had a new like dress and shoes, which she absolutely which was destroyed by mud, and she was sent to room without any food. And if I'm right in thinking, it's after that bit when she has to go to the Pale Man, and we don't know how long she's gone without food. I'm guessing it was more just she was just so hungry, and that she let her hunger, and I think that was part of hypnotism as well. The hunger took over, and she ate the grapes, and I think that's part of it. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense there. All right. So after she tastes the grapes, the creature wakes up and is some of the most greatest makeup design I've seen. I'm kind of surprised, but I don't believe this movie was ever nominated for Best Makeup at the Oscars.
Hang on. I think it may have won, but I'll check.
I'm checking right now. Okay, so yes, it did at Best Achievement in Makeup. It did. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It definitely earned it.
Definitely did. Okay. Well, that was right about that. All right. Good. All right. Yes. Very happy about that, because I guess the moment when the creature wakes up and he grabs those fairies and bites into them, apparently, I guess Doug Jones was just biting into blood-filled condoms, and that's how they got the effect for some of that stuff right there. And I think it's kind of cool, too, because there's a lot of good mixture of CG effects and practical effects in this.
Yeah.
Which I'm always happy when filmmakers just use CG effects to enhance a practical effect, and that's what it should be. CG should just be used to enhance an already practical effect. And I think during the screening of this, I guess Stephen King went to a screening of this movie, and that Pale Man sequence was super terrifying for him, because when she runs, all right, when I saw this in theaters, this was the most like intense moment of the year, and apparently of any other horror film I saw that year, because she just tries to get her chair up and the thing starts to close, and she quickly has to make another door on the ceiling with a chalk, and she just barely gets out there, and that scream the Pale Man makes is super terrifying. But I also want to comment too on the production design, which I thought was absolutely
gorgeous.
And, you know, that did win for Best Production Design at the Oscars of the year of 2007. And I'm very glad to hear about that. But I don't think this movie was nominated for Best Foreign Film.
I think it lost to The Lives of Others.
It did, okay.
Granted, that year, that was a very hard choice, because The Lives of Others, it's an equally brilliant film, but in a completely different way.
Yeah, well, I'm still kind of glad to know that Pan's Labyrinth did win in all the categories that it deservedly won for, especially for art direction, and also, like, I think it won for cinematography as well.
Yeah.
So I was really glad to learn about that. I think director of photography was Guillermo Navarro. I'm trying to look up right now who the winner for... Oh, yeah. Eugenio Caballero was the art director for Pan's Labyrinth. You can definitely see that with the lair, but not only the lair, but the place where the rubbles were handed out, the house.
The labyrinth itself.
Yep, the labyrinth itself that they live in there too. Very ingenious movie. But yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite moments, was that sequence there. Another scene I definitely do want to discuss is when Mercedes does take her revenge
on
the captain.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's it. Another great piece of makeup work there.
Yes. All right. So after we find out about, okay, and now I don't know if the scene comes after or before the doctor trying to euthanize the guy that got tortured. Yeah. Because there's a moment.
I think it's after.
Okay. So yeah, so after one of the rebels gets caught, the doctor is told to come in and look at him because they want to keep him alive. All right. They want to keep him alive, and
it's the one that has the stammer.
Yeah, the guy that stammered. So they bring the doctor in to make sure that he can still be alive, and the doctor doesn't obey, and he does give him a shot to take away all the pain, and so that he can just pass on. And when the doctor finds out about this, he gets mad and asks him why he didn't obey him. And during this time, too, I guess the rebels are stealing supplies from the store. And they set off a fake explosion somewhere else to draw their crowds away. But the captain does find out eventually that it was Mercedes, his main housekeeper cook, who was helping out with the theft of his supply closet. And he starts to do the same thing that he does to the Stammer Man, you know, telling her about the different tools. And you think the same thing is going to happen to her. But no, like a badass, she had a knife hidden with her. And she takes it to his cheek and says, "If you touch that little girl again, I'll kill you." And slices his cheek open. But I think there's one moment that happens a few scenes later when he sews up his cheek back up. And, I don't understand why does he take I'm sure he's thirsty, but he takes a swig of rum or something like that and it starts to bleed and open up again. I think that's more cringeworthy than her actually cutting the cheek.
Yeah, it's the same. It's like any scenes like that, I find those really hard to watch.
Yeah.
And without doing swigging the rum just to dull the pain of what he's about to do. That's just that set up. And then when you actually see him pushing the knees, I could barely watch that scene.
Gosh, yes. Gosh. I just, one thing I find, and maybe I'm not saying this right, and I probably should go back and listen to some of the director's commentary, but even though I think it's a beautifully told story, I kind of saw the movie more from what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to look at the movie from Ophelia's point of view, and she's trying to do all these tasks of trying to see if she's like this princess. I guess, and maybe tell me about this, Tony, but I never quite understood the juxtaposition between the real world with the Spanish Civil War and like the fantasy stuff. To me, I think they work well together, but I can't explain to anyone why it is told that way.
Yeah, I'd say it's not really much the fantasy element that does that. It's the horror element. It is the comparing the horrors of fairy tales to the horrors of war. Again, the comparison between like the pale man with the table filled with food, and which also feel like that scene's also a bit of a nod to the myth of Persephone as well. But and then they also compare like the bit with the pale man with all the food, and then we see to the bit we see earlier of the soldiers proudly claiming like bread in Franco's Spain. It's that showing the horrors of fairy tales and the horrors of fascism. It feels like it's those elements that's the comparative elements rather than the fantasy elements, and showing Ophelia using fantasy to escape from the horrors of the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, that's definitely a good point right there. To me, Pan's Labyrinth was such a different type of fairy tale because it did incorporate the Spanish Civil War and shown us what real monsters are like and the rule of Fidel, that even though Ophelia has to deal with all these horrific things, and also she has a mother who becomes sick, and I think one of the most heartbreaking things of the movie is that the Faun tells her about this root that wants to be human, and you put the roots underneath the mother's bed, the mother would get well.
Yeah, the mandrake.
The mandrake, thank you. And she starts to, but then the mother finds out about the root, and when she throws it in the fire, it was heartbreaking too, because the mother says, look, I believed in fairy tales at one time, but now I can't anymore. And when she does that, it's like she kind of kills her own innocence, her own childlike wonder of the world, and that's what eventually kills her. And it's just kind of a...
Yeah, because that's the moment when the birth starts and she dies in childbirth.
Yeah. I always thought that moment there was kind of like heartbreaking to say, hey, look, I believed in stuff once, and she kind of yells at Ophelia too, say, look, you gotta stop this right now too, alright? And in a way, and this is what kind of bothered me about the, not really bothered me about the mother, but something I was kind of confused about when watching it, is the fact that the mother kind of just gives into this captain, because I guess women at the time, they had to have fathers. And she, I think she tells her daughter too when they're in bed that I was just tired of being alone, and the Ophelia says, well, you were never alone, you had me, but I bet apparently for Ophelia's mother she has to have any man in her life, even if it's a dictator asshole, because maybe she thinks that she can't do any better. That's kind of my take about that whole thing right there.
Or also Vidal being charming when he wants to, and probably did charm her.
Yeah, and it's true, during the dinner party sequence there are moments there where he could be kind of charming, you know, he knows the best rich people in the land. He definitely pertains to the 1%. So, yes.
Yeah.
He was kind of, I'm not going to say he's as bad as Trump or anything like that too, but he just got that thing where he could be charming, wants to be, and kind of an asshole most of the time there too. But let's kind of get into more about the ending of this. I know I kind of teased on that earlier, and I apologize if I went over the place with this movie. The ending of this movie, there's a sequence when the Faun asks her to, I guess, the baby got born. All right, the baby was able to be saved. So yeah, she did. The mother did not lose the baby in childbirth. The baby was born, but she died. And she's asked by the Faun character to just take a little piece of blood from the baby. And she refuses that. And that angers him. Gosh. I think she has the baby before she escapes from the captain. Because there's a moment when she is hiding from the captain.
Yeah.
Help me out, Tony, because I apologize too. I'm getting all like my moments here messed up here. But essentially, she's told to hand the baby over to the Faun so she can he can take a piece of blood from him, and she says no. And when she's talking to him, that's when the captain sees her, but she sees that she's talking to no one, and the captain shoots her. All right, and this is when, so he has the baby, and the rebels show up. Now, I'm not quite sure if they shoot him when he's holding the baby, or they get him away, or they get it away, and then they shoot him.
And Vidal knew he was going to die, so he gave the baby and then smashed his watch so that the rebels could tell his son the time of his death, but then they say, no, he won't even know your name.
Yeah, all right.
And then they shoot him.
They shoot him, okay. All right. So after that sequence, and it's really kind of heartbreaking sequence too when he does shoot her, but after he does, she's laying there, and it's the beginning shot of the movie. The beginning of the movie, you know that something happened to Ophelia because blood's dripping and it goes backwards. So you kind of know right from the start that this may have a tragic ending to it. So when she does, I guess, and this is part that, and this, I guess, depending on your views, this could be a either tragic ending or a happy ending, because she does actually wake up in this new world, and she is definitely like a princess in this new land. It comes back to her scene of her being kind of dead in the real world. I always thought of it as she did become a princess, and I guess that has to do with my views on things. So I kind of hope for the best for her. But if you do see it another way there too, well, I completely understand that as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's heartbreaking and yet optimistic at the same time too.
Yeah.
It's definitely like a beautifully a shot movie. It can be kind of confusing to people that don't know about these types of movies. I don't think you have to know anything about Spanish Civil War or anything. It's just about a little girl who visits these new lands.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of, like, Alice in Wonderland and Wizard of Oz, but just with a more stronger horror element to it there, too. But the movie isn't just I know we've been talking about, like, horrific things that happen in this movie, but they are absolutely just beautiful images. My favorite one of the beautiful images I saw was the, I guess, little, like, grasshopper that turns into a fairy. Oh, that's, like, a beautiful moment there. The lullaby that Mercedes sings to Ophelia is just so...
That's hauntingly beautiful.
The whole soundtrack is wonderfully done, and I'm just trying to look up right now if that even got nominated for any awards, and I don't think it did.
I don't think it did.
No, and I'm kind of upset that it didn't.
Yeah, I don't think it did.
Yeah. But, yeah, it did not win, but it was nominated for Best Score.
Yeah. What beat it?
Javier, I'm trying to look right now. Well, I don't know, because I was trying to see. I can't go back. I'm looking things up on my IMDb app, and I cannot see. I'm looking like Oscar nominees, and it won't. God damn it. It's just going to tell me about. I've got to look for Oscars of 2007, and I just don't know how to do that here right now, so I can't. Anyways, it lost that. It lost to someone. I'm not quite sure who.
It lost to Babel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember the music with Babel being good, but it wasn't, like, iconic.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think I'm selling this movie as well as I want to there, Tony, but it's definitely a beautiful movie.
Yeah, it's a hard movie to sell. It's like...
It is.
It's hard to, like, explain why the beauty and magic and the magic of Pan's Labyrinth without spoiling it all. It's like you know, we talk about, but I would say that the best way to go into Pan's Labyrinth is to go in blind
and
just let yourself be surprised by Del Toro's imagination.
Well, when I showed my niece the trailer of this, because she's like 16 now, so I'm thinking, all right, well, she's old enough now, she can definitely watch this movie. And then I showed her the trailer of this, but I think the trailer I showed her was like a fan-made trailer, so I had like a few language in there. I'm like, all right, I can't stop that. But she was really interested in seeing it, and I'm going to have to bring the DVD over to her folks' house and watch it. But here's gonna be the weird thing, too. I know that her dad will not like it because it's a foreign film, and that her mom will be interested for a little bit, but taken back of all the scenes of horror, I think my niece will absolutely love it, because we watched, what's that movie, Spirited Away,
when
she was younger, and she really loved that movie, and I think in a way, Spirited Away could be shown as like a double feature with this, because they both
involve
a young girl going into like this magical environment, and there are some horrific creatures. I think the creature who wears that kind of like white mask, that big sludge blob that eats all the creatures, that kind of reminds me of the Pale Man. There's definitely some horrifying elements in Spirited Away that if it got made into a live action movie, it would have to be directed by Guillermo del Toro, and it would definitely be a little bit more graphic and violent. And so if she loved Spirited Away, I have a feeling that she's also going to love Pan's Labyrinth as well. So I'm really excited to show her those features. And Fragrant too, if you are into fantasy films, it's funny too, because on the front of the DVD box I have, it says, on the same altar of high fantasy as the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that's from a critic from the Entertainment Weekly. And I don't think I would compare this to Lord of the Rings.
No, it's completely different. The closest thing that I would compare it to would be the Ghibli films, Spirited Away, or actually I'd say more prominently Princess Mononoke as well. I'd say that's a good comparison as well.
That would be an excellent one right there too. Oh gosh, definitely. I think it has more in line with Studio Ghibli films, like you said, than The Lord of the Rings, just because there are more fantastical creatures in those stories than Lord of the Rings. I mean, Lord of the Rings, they have the orcs and I guess those tree creatures. I mean, there are definitely some good creatures. What was that?
The Ents.
Ents, yes. I think there are some wonderful creatures in Lord of the Rings, but they're not as fantastic as the ones in Ghibli films, and definitely in Totoro's films too. I mean, gosh, all the creatures in Hellboy and all that stuff right there. I have to ask you, buddy, what is your favorite Totoro film? Pan's Labyrinth.
Besides Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
It is a tough one, but it's really tough because like the Hellboy films are up there, and Crimson Peak's up there, but I have to say Pacific Rim.
I love that movie.
It's just so much fun. Del Toro said he made it for his inner 13-year-old boy, and you can just feel his glee at being able to just make a proper kaiju film and just go to town with all the monsters and the robots. That he had a lot of great. Mostly him and his design team had a lot of fun designing all of the monsters and all the robots in the film, and it's just. But it's also like a brilliant piece of world building as well. Like the first like 5-10 minutes of Pacific Rim, it's. Yeah, and even after that, it just feels like such a real lived in world for all the characters, like churches and villages cropping up around kaiju skeletons and games being made about the war and tortures and made shows. It's just a great bit of world building that's very evident. Would not have put the time and effort into creating a world like the one Pacific Rim is in, but in the hands of Del Toro, he just makes this a brilliant world and just a really great, fun film.
Yeah, totally agree with that. Here are some upcoming supposed projects that he's doing.
Yeah.
Apparently, I maybe written a screenplay for the Orphanage remake.
Yeah.
Which may be kind of fascinating. He's going to do Pinocchio. About Pinocchio, like a live action version of Pinocchio, the witches, and I'm wondering if it's gonna be the movie with Angelica Houston, the Roald Dahl novel.
It is that one, and and I heard like he was doing that with Alfonso Cuarón, and those two working on Roald Dahl. That's just the like a, especially with the witches, like that's a perfect match.
It would be, and I love the original movie. Nicholas Rogue directed it. I love the makeup effects. Yeah. I think Jim Henson did a great like puppeteer work on that movie, or Jim Henson Productions. So Frankenstein, he's doing a story about Frankenstein, which could be kind of fun. I expect big things. Now, have you seen The Shape of Water?
That just has part of the reason why I'd say Pacific Rim is one of my favourites is now because The Shape of Water is only out in the UK. It's just over a week after recording this. It's actually out on Valentine's Day here in the UK.
It is, okay.
To go to one of the advanced screenings of it.
Okay, so I wasn't quite sure if you got it over there yet or not. Okay, all right.
Now, I know there have been like some screenings in the UK, but I've not been able to go to any of those advanced ones.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I love Pacific Rim, but that's more for the 13-year-old me. But yeah, probably my favorite movie next to Pan's Labyrinth is gotta be The Shape of Water. In fact, The Shape of Water may become my favorite Del Toro film after I watched it a couple more times. But yeah, I absolutely fell in love with that movie, and he won the Golden Globe. And I think he's probably a key reason, he will win for Best Director at the Oscars.
I think so, yeah.
I'm hoping that the film gets picked up for some art design awards.
Actually, that's one of the things I'm annoyed at. The Shape of Water wasn't nominated for Best Makeup or Best Visual Effects. Even just from watching the trailers, it should have been nominated for those awards.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. All right, you know, I mean, I'm still kind of surprised that I watched Lady Bird last night, and I'm still kind of surprised that got picked up for so many awards because I thought it was. But I'm a minority.
I can't really comment on that because again, that actually comes out the day after The Shape of Water does in the UK.
Really? Gosh, I'm sorry, guys. All right. But wait here. If it's coming out, so help me explain this, all right? Because isn't the BAFTAs the British Film Awards?
Yeah, I don't really know why BAFTAs work, but mostly goes on the American release schedules, except for British films where if it's a British film that's released in the consideration year, then it counts. That's why Paddington 2 and The Death of Stalin are up for BAFTAs this year, but probably only be up, but only up for consideration for Oscars next year.
Yeah, I don't
really know how the BAFTAs work.
I was kind of curious about that because if all of these movies are coming out in 2018. Would they be eligible for the BAFTAs for 2018 because that's when they get released there? But apparently, according to them, they can pick movies from America's releases too. I was kind of curious about that, but I wasn't trying to make assumptions about anything. I was just kind of curious about how the whole thing works out there because it just confuses the hell out of me and I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So, All right, well, I don't have anything else really left to say about Pan's Labyrinth, except to go see it. I'm sure everyone that hears this episode has already seen Pan's Labyrinth, like, a million times. I mean, we can gush all about the production design, the music, the cast, who are all very wonderful, the direction. I definitely think that this is the moment when Guillermo del Toro really established himself as being a director to notice. And people have noticed his other movies before, like Devil's Backbone, and like I said before, the Hellboy series, and like Blade 2. And people noticed him, but they kind of noticed him as being like kind of an action director, or definitely a niche mature director. I think this is the first time where people started to notice that he could be considered to be a real director. And like I said before earlier on other views of The Shape of Water, that movie I know win him the best director, but this movie is the one that really got people to notice him more. And I'm very excited about his other features. Yeah, I don't got nothing to say. Most people know about Totoro because, yeah, this his love of like horror films and classic films. I know there's an art museum of where I live, and they brought in a whole bunch of his paintings and his artifacts and his different memorabilia from other movies, and that was kind of cool to see. But if I guess, Tony, to close the show out here, if you had to say anything else about Pan's Labyrinth, and if you want to give it a score, I'm going to give my score as like a 5 out of 5. I think it's perfect. Yeah. I can't say anything wrong about it, but tell everyone any closing thoughts about Pan's Labyrinth and your final score, buddy.
Yeah, like I agree. I'll say like we could talk like for hours about Pan's Labyrinth, and even today we've only barely scratched the surface on why Pan's Labyrinth is such an amazing film, and just how just the brilliant imagination that Del Toro has. Like I've like seen some of the pages from his notebooks with all the all the designs he had for all of the creatures. Those that's just they're pieces of art in and of themselves, and yeah, and it's always like, and with Del Toro, I always get disappointed when I find out other ones that could have been, like how he was originally going to do the Hobbit films, and how Universal approached him to actually do the Dark Universe, but he would have started with Creature from the Black Lagoon, but they didn't like his idea for it, and so he turned that into The Shape of Water. And after The Mummy, I'm just disappointed that we didn't get Guillermo del Toro doing the Universal Monsters, because that would have been amazing. But going back to Pan's Labyrinth, even with The Shape of Water, this is the film that Del Toro will be remembered for. Like, this is the film that the old films like starting, but you know, got people to notice him. But Pan's Labyrinth is the one that really put him on the map. Like, you got hints of all of his ideas with like Cronos and like two of the Hellboy films, but he the first time that he's truly able and the Devil's Backbone, but he's only truly able to bring all of his creativity and his ideas all fully together with Pan's Labyrinth. And yeah, it's just an amazing film. And yeah, I mean, it's obviously he's giving it a 5 out of 5.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a piece of art.
Well, you mentioned too about him going to do like the Dark Universe, or have him help out with the Dark Universe. And while that would have been fun to see his take on it, though, I still think the studios would rein in and want him to do their versions of these creatures instead of his. And I don't think that his original voice would be established in that. Because here's the thing, too. Whenever like studios hire a director, most of the time the director is looking at pre-visualizations of dailies before they shoot anything. So I think that the studios would just want his name on there, and that's it.
And yeah, capitalize. And I mean, that's and the other thing I said, that's why he left. Like, he wants to put his own firm stamp on Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Universal wouldn't let him, so he left.
Yeah, and that's good too. So because I
he left and did The Shape of Water,
which is I think is a brilliant thing. And yes, The Shape of Water is a good retelling of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I don't think I could say it any better than that. But yeah, I we both give Pan's Labyrinth high praise, big respect to Guillermo del Toro. Most people that are fans of the site and the show, they know who Guillermo del Toro is, and they'll definitely watch anything of his. So yeah, that is going to take care of this episode of Cinema Recall, praising del Toro and Pan's Labyrinth. Our next poll, we are going to be looking at the films of Paul Thomas Anderson. And I have 5 choices for readers to vote on, and you can vote on that on the site thatmomentin.com. All right, so the five choices are going to be Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood, and The Master. And I was kind of toying if I should do Inherited Vice or The Master, because I still think Inherited Vice might be an interesting movie to talk about, but I'm sticking with those five. I don't know, Tony, which of those five would you choose?
I think probably for me, I'd probably go with that Will Be Blood.
Okay, and I have a feeling too that's the one that most everyone is going to choose, There Will Be Blood, because there's definitely...
It's going to be between There Will Be Blood and Boogie Nights, I'd say.
Okay, fair enough, though, yes. No Punch Drunk Love or Magnolia Love?
I'd say those two are, but they don't have, like, the same, like, prestige that, or widespread acclaim that Boogie Nights and that will be Blood have.
That's true. That's true. And they're two completely different style of movies, too. I mean, like, it's completely different genres right there, and I'll be very excited to get into that movie with our next upcoming guest. I'm not quite sure who that will be. But, Tony, before we go, good sir, tell the listeners out there where they can find you, all right?
So, yeah, you can find me over at coosreviews.wordpress.com, and I also do some writing for the Large Association of Movie Blogs, The LAM, which I focus on directors, and the one I'm highlighting for this month is Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, nice! Yeah,
and also over on The LAM, I've also done a piece on the nominees for Best Animated Film Oscar, and spoiler, it's a massive rant about Lego Batman and anime films not being nominated.
Thank you so much, because I'm kind of sick and tired of Pixar just being nominated for everything and them winning a whole bunch. I think the last anime movie to win was Spirited Away. And there hasn't been.
I think Curse of the Were-Rabbit was in Gromit. Curse of the Were-Rabbit ran after that, but after that, I can't remember if it the last the on. I think there was in Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit, and Happy Feet, but after those two, I can't remember if there are any others that more than that Disney Pixar didn't win.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, there have been like a few, but there definitely has been like a lack of like anime movies being nominated.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a definitely sad thing. Like, Your Name was a beautiful movie.
That should have been nominated. Like that for me, last year's Oscars, that was the big snub at last year's Oscars, yeah. Was Your Name not being nominated.
Yeah, exactly. See? All right, well, I definitely want to check that out, and you can read that article over at largeassmovieblogs.com. As for the Cinema Recall podcast, folks, as always, you can listen to all of our past episodes by going to the site thatmomentin.com. We're on Stitcher, Podomatic, iTunes, Player FM, few other places. I think SoundCloud we're on still. Few other places you can listen to podcasts. You can definitely check us out on Twitter @cinema_recall. You're on Facebook, just type in the Cinema Recall there. And I think it's going to wrap up this episode of Cinema Recall. Again, thank you so much to everyone for listening. Big thank you to you, Tony Coogan, for being on our show. Appreciate that very much, good sir.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, man. And hopefully I will have you back on here again soon, too, okay?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
All right, buddy. All right, well, good night, everybody, and I hope you have a great night. Take care.